Okay. So get a bit of a change today from Ajahn Brahm. Now that you are, in a sense, coming to the end of this retreat, you've been here for about a week now, is that right? 9 days or whatever? Yeah? Okay, good. So coming to the end, and whenever you come to the end of a retreat, it's like you have to start to think about, well, what am I going to do next? Right? What is life going to be like when I go back to Hong Kong or whatever it is? And this is the one of the things about the Buddha's teaching, is that it's always about kind of continuing to move forward on the Buddhist path, right? It's not, you don't stop, you kind of go on a retreat and you kind of stop. It's an integrated picture whereby your daily life, your life at work, with your family or whatever it is, your friends, it's all part of the same Buddhist practice. You can't divide things up and say my Buddhist practice is one thing and the rest of my life is something else. If you do it like that, it's not going to work. So you have to kind of integrate the whole thing here. And one way of finding out whether your life as a, you know, your Buddhist practice works or doesn't work in the long run, whether it gives the kind of results that you should expect from the Buddhist practice, is actually to see what happens when you go on a retreat like this. Do you get, you know, the happiness that meditation is supposed to provide? Do you get the kind of peace? Do you get the joy that meditation provides? But even more important than that is actually that you see that from year to year, let's say you come back to Jhana Grove again next year, or you go on a retreat somewhere else, what you should see is that there is a change, right? There's a movement. There's a movement in the right direction, whereby you feel that next time around, you actually, you're more mindful, right? There's more happiness in the meditation. There's more peace. And all of these qualities are actually growing. And when they're growing, that's when you know that you're on the right track and you're heading in the right direction. And you know that your life also in daily life is actually working. It's all pushing you in the right, in the same way. And there's a nice place where the Buddha in the suttas, where the Buddha talks about, it's a tiny little sutta, which is very, kind of seems very innocuous in many ways. But the Buddha is walking around and he sees monks in different places, and one of the first things he sees is a monk sitting next to the village, and this monk is sitting next to the village and is sitting very straight, right, and it looks like his meditation is going very well and everything is very fine, but then the Buddha says, very surprisingly, he says that I'm not happy with that monk. And then he says, why? Well, the reason is because he's sitting too close to the village, right? You know, when you sit close to the village, what will happen is that you will get disrupted. And somebody will come and start talking to you. Some kind of sensual pleasure will come and entice you. And then you will be taken away from that samadhi that you had before because of that. And then the Buddha goes into the forest. And when he goes into the forest, he sees a monk. And he sees a monk kind of really tired, like, you know, nodding or whatever, dozing away in the forest somewhere. And then the Buddha says, again, it's in the suttas, right? This is supposedly what the Buddha did say. He says, I'm happy with that monk. Why am I happy with that monk? Because he's sitting in the forest. Because he's sitting in the forest, he won't be disturbed. Because of that, he will be able to overcome that tiredness, overcome those defilements. And then he will be able to attain the meditations and the insights and all the other things of the Buddhist path. So you can see here, the point is not where you're at so much. It's not whether you had some kind of wonderful experience on this retreat or not. I mean, it's great if you do, of course, it's very helpful. That's not really the point. The point is whether we are heading in the right direction. That is what really matters on the Buddhist path. And if you are heading in the right direction, you're going the right way, then you know you're doing the right thing. And this was the whole point with the story of this monk. The monk who was nodding, tired in the forest, he was heading in the right way. Because he was doing the right thing here. Whereas the monk who was sitting on the outskirts of the village, there was always a chance that he would backslide and go backwards. So this is what we should look at. And when you look at it that way, you have a beautiful way of deciding whether your practice is working or not. Right? Very pragmatic, very down to earth. And you can decide whether this is going to work for you or not. And this is the beauty of the Buddha's teachings. They're often very simple, very pragmatic, very straight to the point. So this is how you look at these things. So what then should we do in ordinary life? How shall we live our life in such a way that it supports our meditation practice? That next time you come back here or you go somewhere else or whatever it is, you feel that there is an improvement. What should we do? And to be able to, there's many ways of answering that question. But to be able to look at that, I want to, first of all, just talk a little bit about the progress, or the psychology, if you like, of meditation, according to how the Buddha taught these things. And the Buddha has is a sutta which is quite often quoted, you know, all over the place. And this sutta recurs in many, many places in the, you know, in the early teachings of Buddhism. And this is sutta is basically about what you might call the psychology of meditation. What does psychology of meditation mean? It means how does meditation, what does it feel like to you, right? How do you actually feel the progress of meditation inside of yourself? That is the psychology of meditation. So this psychology of meditation shows you how you suppose how meditation progresses from the very beginning all the way to the very end. How does that feel personally? That is what it shows you. And what this sutta says is that you, the very first factor, this is a conditioned sequence of factors. It starts with one, and then it leads to the second one, and the first one conditions the second one. The second one conditions the third, all the way up till you reach final liberation on the Buddhist path. The first factor is virtue, right? Sila, sila in the Pali language. And then this sutta says that if you have virtue, it cannot be done through the will. It says it's an automatic process that from virtue you get what is called non-remorse, is what they call in that sutta. So from virtue comes non-remorse. And the sutta says this is an automatic process, it's according to nature that from virtue comes non-remorse. And it specifically says this is not something that can be done through willpower. It's only something that happens in according to natural laws. And then when you have non-remorse, the sutta says, the next factor is you get joy. Pamuja in the Pali language. Pamuja, joy, comes from non-remorse. If you have non-remorse, the next factor is you get rapture, piti in the Pali language. From piti comes prasadi, which is tranquility. Right? From prasadi comes sukha, which is happiness. And from sukha comes samadhi. And then from samadhi, you get all the insights and the liberation, all that kind, all those kind of things. And the point about this sutta is that between each of these steps, it is a natural law that if you have the previous one, the one which comes after will arise as a consequence. It's a natural law. And the sutta specifically says that this cannot be done through will. It cannot be done through willpower. It has to happen according to natural law of cause and effect. This is a very powerful sutta. I mean, you have been on the retreat with, you know, with Ajahn Brahmana for 9 days, and the way he teaches meditation is just to basically sit back and just relax and just wait, right? Be patient. That's basically what it's all about. It's about your attitude, to be kind, to be gentle. But it's not supposed to do anything. And this, if you look at this sutta, this is exactly what the sutta says. It says that this cannot be done through willpower. It is a natural law that if you put into place the previous factor, the subsequent factor will arise as a consequence. There's no willpower in there, right? It's a beautiful natural sequence that happens. And one of the things that I always found that inspires me, you know, when on this path, is that when I see that how the Buddha teaches something, how he teaches meditation or Dhamma or whatever, when that matches with how your teacher teaches it, it kind of strengthens the feeling of confidence, right? Something must be right. And this is what you're seeing here. There is a match with the way the Buddha teaches meditation. No willpower is required. And what that means, of course, is that you just can do that with the meditation if you're ready, if your mind is in the right place, if the basic conditions are in place. All you have to do is sit back, close your eyes, relax, right, and just feel the peace around you, and the meditation goes all by itself. Nothing you have to do at all. So this is kind of one of these basic teachings. One of the interesting things about this is that if you have a sequence like that, where everything happens naturally, one factor after the other, well, what does that mean? Well, what that means is that the very first factor is the most important one, right? It means that if the first factor of these factors is in place, then everything else will happen as a consequence. So what it means is that instead of focusing on the factors which are higher on this path, what you have to focus on is the very first one. That is the one that actually matters. Because if you focus on that one, and that one becomes strong, then the sequence takes off. Now, the first factor in the sequence I was just talking about was sila, is virtue. So virtue is the thing that actually matters. That is where the focus needs to be put. So I'm going to talk about virtue a little bit more afterwards. But before I do that, I want to have a look at some of the other important aspects of this particular sutta I was just talking about. And one of the things you may have heard when I was talking about it now, you heard the sequence includes, it starts basically with sila, then you have non-remorse, right? Not being remorseful is a state of kind of an absence of a type of suffering. Then you have the joy which arises, comes next one. And from the joy you have the rapture. From the rapture you have the tranquility, and then you have the sukha, which is the happiness. And what you see there is that everything about Buddhist meditation, all of these factors are just different ways of describing happiness, right? Different states of happiness. Isn't that a beautiful thing? Everything about Buddhist meditation is about happiness from the very beginning all the way to the very end. It's all kind of, that's what it's all about. And it's so, it's such a powerful teaching. And remember, this is not just kind of I'm not just picking out a random sutta in this, you know, to make a point here. This is one of the basic teachings in Buddhism, this idea of causality in meditation. You see it again and again in the suttas. And this is how you decide whether a particular teaching of the Buddha is important or not. The way you decide is how often he taught it, right? If he taught it again and again, it means that different audiences would have heard it in different places. It would have been something that the Buddha considered extremely important. Otherwise, it wouldn't have occurred so many different places. This is one of the foundational things, that meditation, how you're supposed to experience it. This is the psychology of meditation. How you're supposed to experience it is as through happiness, through a positive experience. It's all about happiness all the way through. Different types of happiness, right? When I use the word happiness, I mean it in a very broad sense. Lack of remorse, the feeling of joy, feeling of gladness, feeling of tranquility, feeling of peace, feeling of just feeling good inside of yourself. All of these things are part of this thing we call happiness in Buddhism. That is what the whole Buddhist meditation is about. And again, it's very powerful to remember that, because when you see that, you have some idea where this path is leading you. And that brings me to the second point about this. The reason why the Buddha gives a teaching like this is that one reason for that is because it gives you some milestones, right? It gives you some markers to know whether you're heading in the right direction. Are you getting that non-remorse in your meditation? Are you getting the gladness and the joy? Are you getting the sense of piti? Piti rapture is often like a physical feeling of kind of joy in the body, where the whole body is kind of vibrating a bit, and you feel a sense of happiness. You can feel it physically sometimes. Are you getting that in your meditation? And if you're getting these things, you have some idea where you are on this path, right? And then these are like the milestones. You can actually see whether you are improving or not, right? So you see, okay, last year I got a bit of joy. This year I'm getting piti. I can reach the next milestone. You know, milestones are these things they had in Europe in the old days. Milestones are the kind of things you see on the side of the road. And it says kind of, you know, the next name of the next town, and it says so and so many kilometers, right? These are like the milestones of meditation. It tells you how many kilometers you have to go to get to the next stage of rapture or whatever. So this is the idea here. This, because it is about psychology, because it is about our experience, it shows you, it is a guide to you know, whether we're heading in the right direction or not. And so you can see, so if you are increasing in happiness, increasing in peace, then you're heading in the right direction. You're moving the right way. So again, this is the usefulness of this kind of teaching. It gives you a kind of a roadmap, right? Okay, maps are very useful. This is the map for for meditation practice. Okay, so these are some of the kind of basic things that you see in the suttas about meditation. But again, one of the reasons why I'm bringing this out now is that this whole conditioned sequence, this whole automatic process of meditation happens because the very first factor is put into place. And the very first factor in this here is sila. The word sila in Pali is very often translated as virtue into English. And virtue is perhaps too narrow. The idea with sila in Pali, it has to do with your whole character. who you are as a person, with your habits, with how you look at life, how your character development basically is what sila is about. It's a very broad idea. It includes, as I like to say, it includes not only not doing the bad things in life, but it includes things like doing the good stuff, right? Not only are you supposed to avoid doing the bad, you're supposed to actually actively do good things in the world. But more important than that, and this is kind of often the hardest part of the Buddhist path, is that it's not just about what we do through body and speech. It's actually also about how we think, what our mind state is like. This is also part of sila, because this is part of habit and character, right? The character is also what your mind is like. So this is the hard part. So when we practice as Buddhists, we have to also not only look at our external actions, but how do we actually work with our mind? This is an important part of how this whole thing works out. So to understand this idea of sila in a bit more detail, there's many things you can focus on, but there is something in the Buddhist practice called the 10 aspect that the Dasa Akusala Kammapada is called in Pali. It means the 10 pathways of wholesome actions or something like that. And this is a summary that the Buddha has. It's a kind of it's a summary, but it's kind of the broadest expression of sila on the Buddhist path. And this is divided into three types of bodily action, right? Bodily action, the avoiding to kill, but to be compassionate, avoiding to steal, but to be generous, avoiding sexual misconduct. And you have the right speech, which is to avoid the lying, but to be truthful, etc., to avoid the slanderous speech, but to actually bring people together, to avoid the harsh speech, to speak the kind speech, and to avoid the idle chatter, but to, as the Buddha says, to speak speech which is treasured by people, right? The people kind of speed up when people listen and say, wow, that's really nice, that's really good. I want to treasure that, I want to keep it with me into the future. That's the kind of the beautiful speech. But then you have the mental actions. And in the mental actions, there's three types. And one is avoiding the covetousness, in other words, the desire for the belongings of others, not having that kind of covetous mind, avoiding the ill will, the anger inside, and to have obviously compassion, loving kindness instead. But the last one, that's the one I wanted to focus on now, the last one is to have right view. Right view is an aspect of virtue in Buddhism. How can right view be an aspect of virtue? And the reason is because the view is very often what kind of, if you have the right view, it means that you're heading in the right way. If you look at the world in the right way, it means that you're heading in the right direction. Everything else follows as a consequence from right view. So right view is actually a aspect of virtue in Buddhism. And this is the thing I want you to focus on in the remainder of this talk. What does actually Buddha mean by right view in this context? So first of all, right view in Buddhism, there's two types of right view. There's a right view which you get when you become a noble person, an Arya. This is like the three mentors and the Arahants and these sort of things. And that is a very kind of elevated right view. It's a right view which comes from direct insight into the nature of reality. But for the vast majority of people, that kind of right view, it's nice to know about it, know what it means, but it's not as practical. The practical kind of right view is what the Buddha talks about in this particular context. How should ordinary people, people who are not Aryas, which is 99.99999, I don't know how many nines, but lots of nines anyway, percent of people, that's what they need to focus on, right? So what is this all about? Now, the first thing, again, to understand about right view is that if you don't have right view, you can't really act rightly, right? If you have wrong view, you're going to make all kind of bad decisions in life. The whole idea of right view is that it helps you to make all the right decisions. And to give you an example of how this works, it's like, you know, if you're going to invest in a stock market in a particular share, right? There's a company and you have all the wrong information about this company. That's like wrong view, right? You've got all the wrong information. You have a really, really bad broker who tells you maybe he lies to you or whatever. Who knows what's happening here? But anyway, you've got all the wrong information here. And then you invest in this stock. And what happens? You come to grief and suffering because you lose all your money because you had all the wrong information here. So wrong view leads to suffering because you make all the wrong decisions based on wrong view here. However, if you have really good information, if you have insider's information, right, And then you invest, I'm not suggesting you should actually buy, you know, in this way, but if you have really good information, whatever it is, you buy the right stock, and then the stock goes up, and you make money as a consequence. So right view leads to happiness. And this is exactly parallel with the Buddhist path. Whenever you have wrong view in life about anything, it leads you in the wrong direction. Whenever you have right view, you can make the right choices as a consequence of right view. And when you make the right choices, of course, it would precisely lead to happiness and lead in the right way. So the right view is essential. Only when you have right view can you actually move forward on this path. So what are some of the factors of right view that the Buddha was talking about here? And there is a number of things here. And I think probably the most basic one of these things is that all these factors is the idea, the faith, the confidence, if you like, that there are beings in this world who have seen something more than what we have seen. Beings in this world have understood that there is this world, there is the other world. In other words, there is this idea of rebirth. Beings who have understood that there is an idea of karma. Beings who have seen something larger, a broader picture, right? Something more than just ordinary human existence. This is the first thing you need to have. When you have confidence in this, that is what kind of starts you off on the Buddhist practice. If you don't have confidence in that, well then the Buddha doesn't really make any sense anymore, right? The whole idea of having confidence in the Buddha, this idea of somebody who has seen something more than what we have seen, somebody who has a broader picture, somebody who has an understanding of happiness and suffering, somebody who understands the human predicament and is able to guide us in the right way. So this is like the basic thing here. So for anyone who doesn't have that, they're going to reject the Buddha's teaching straight away, because for them it doesn't make any sense. So how can we strengthen that? How can we strengthen this idea that there are people in this world who have seen something more, have an understanding that is greater than ourselves? How can we make that more alive, come more true for ourselves? Because again, the point here is that when you strengthen the virtue, when you strengthen the first aspect of this Buddhist path, the rest happens by itself, right? So all of this thing I'm talking about now is that to strengthen the Buddhist path from taking off. So how can we get more into that? And part of that, of course, is to see what you might call living examples of Buddhism today. One of the best, one of the most important things in my life has been to actually come into contact with people I feel have seen some of these teachings, understood some of these teachings. When you see that, it brings the teachings alive, right? You see that the qualities the Buddha was talking about, the qualities of peace, of kindness, also the qualities of wisdom, insight, they actually exist. They exist in the world today. They're not just something which is stored away in some kind of ancient book which you don't really have all that much access to. But actually, it exists in the present day. So that is an important part of it, is the idea that, you know, just to sometimes be around people who you feel have that kind of insight, understanding. And that drives confidence that these teachings actually work. This is the first one. But for that to be meaningful, for it actually to be possible to really rely on that, it has to exist in a certain context. And that context is the teachings of the Buddha himself. It is only when you see the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of the Buddha match with what kind of currently is taught in the world, that is when you can have a sense of increased confidence in what is going on. And how do you get that? And the way you get that is actually by sometimes taking the books of the Buddha out and reading some of the beautiful teachings of the Buddha. And when you read some of those teachings and you see for yourself what they're like, sometimes it depends a bit on your personality. But for some people, it can be a powerful eye-opener and a very beautiful thing to read some of these teachings. There's so much beautiful things in the suttas. There's so much beautiful similes and stories that were taught by the Buddha. And when you read them, sometimes you recognize, it's almost like the Buddha is talking directly to you. You feel, wow, that's me, right? Here is somebody who taught 2,500 years ago in a culture quite different from the present culture of our present world. And yet, when you read the suttas, it's almost like he's talking directly to you. You think, jeepers, that's amazing. How is that possible? You know, with this vast kind of span of culture and time, and still he's talking directly to us in this way. There's something very powerful about that. There's something which tells you that this person had some sort of insight into the human condition that is valid across time, across cultures. It is a core aspect of what it means to be a human being. So you read that and you gain enormous confidence. And then there's all the beautiful similes that the Buddha taught, all the nice little stories, all of these things. And when you read all this together, it becomes so powerful, such a delightful thing here. So I would recommend all of you, if you have the chance, to sometimes read a little bit of Buddhist suttas. I'm very happy to recommend some books for you if you like. But there's so much good things available now, in English at least, and I think in many other languages as well. And you bring it out, and you just read a little bit. And if you don't like a sutta, just skip that one and go to the next one, right? Don't kind of, sometimes people think, oh, I got to read the whole thing, or to force myself to read the suttas, and have this, 5,000 pages of suttas, and you start from there, and you read all the way through. But don't do that. If you do that, it becomes like a chore, right? And if it is a chore, it loses kind of its fun, and it loses its kind of, it's joy for you. So just pick it up, look at the page, now that's boring, look at another page, no, don't really like that. And then come to something you like, and when you like something, okay, this, I will read that one, and that actually makes sense to you, take that on board. And then later on, you go back to the sutta you thought was boring, and you think, well, actually, it's not boring at all, it's actually very interesting, right? So this is how you kind of expand your understanding of the teaching of the Buddha. And it's very beautiful. It gives rise to inspiration. It gives rise to this feeling that there are people in this world that have seen something more, that have a larger vision. And this is so important, right? This is kind of the whole point of human existence sometimes. We feel that we are kind of trapped in this existence with its sufferings and with its happiness. It's wonderful to have this larger picture. This picture we see something more, something outside, which gives a hope that there is actually something we can move towards, a greater kind of happiness, a greater kind of meaning in life. It's a very powerful thing, a very important thing for life to actually be truly meaningful. So this is the first thing about right view and about virtue. Get a feeling for the fact that there are beings in this world who are awakened, if you like, have seen something more. That is the foundational one. Another thing that the Buddha talks about in the sutta, and he in this particular idea of right view, is he talks about, he says, the very thing, very first thing he says there is that there is what is given, there is what is offered, right? There is what is given, there is what is offered. And sometimes it's the word of the Buddha is sometimes very, it's tricky. When you read that first time, you think, yeah, there is what is given, there is what is offered. You think, okay. And you kind of read on because it doesn't really strike you as anything special, right? Yeah, sure, there is what is given. Of course, you give something and it's given. What's the big deal? It doesn't strike you as something special. But as you read more and more of the suttas, these little tiny little phrases, these little words here and there, start to come out and they start to become meaningful to you and they start to have some special significance. And if the Buddha says this at the very beginning of the Buddha's path, if he says this as part of right view, right, there is what is given, it means it must have some kind of significance. It is important. It's not something that he just says in passing because, whatever. It must have some kind of a significance there. In fact, it must be very important. And of course, as you read the suttas, you start to become clear why this is the case. And the reason it is the case is because one of the foundation stones of the Buddha's teachings is always generosity. Generosity is there as one of the kind of basic things in life. So remember that. Take this into your consciousness and remember that this actually is a foundation stone of the Buddhist path. Actually, it is very fundamental. And I know that many people, particularly from East Asian cultures, are often very generous, and that is great. I think that's a wonderful thing. It's something that is very valuable in those cultures, and it's a very good thing. But remember that generosity is not just about just giving as such. It's also about how you give, right? The how of giving is just as important as the actual fact of generosity itself. So remember that. This is one of the kind of the crucial differences here between giving well and just giving. And one of the things that the Buddha said when he was asked by, who was it who asked the Buddha? I think it may have been a king. Was it a king? It was a king, it was King Pasenadi, I think it was. King Pasenadi, of course, and I was the one who asked him. And he asked them, where should a gift be given, right? Where should a gift be given? And you might think the Buddha might say, oh, you should give it to the Sangha, right? You know, that kind of would be a, you know, probably true. Maybe that's true. But the Buddha didn't say that. What the Buddha said, he said that you should give wherever your heart inclines, wherever you feel like giving, that's where you should be giving. Wherever your heart gets peaceful and calm, that's where you should be giving, right? That's it's a beautiful answer. It means that when you go out into the, you know, whenever you feel that a sense of compassion arises, whenever you feel that this is a good place to give, whenever you feel that something is worthy of your support, that is the right time to give. It's not just to Buddhism. It's not just your favorite temple. It's not just your favorite monk or whatever it is. It is wherever you feel inspired to give, that is the right time to give. It's a very beautiful message. It takes away this kind of narrow-minded idea. We must give to Buddhism. We must give to this. And it broadens out the mind to look at the world in a much bigger and wider sense. And that is why it is so beautiful. And one of the main reasons why this is so important, that we should give where the heart inclines, is because whenever you give where the heart inclines, it's easy to give, right? You give and it's easy to give out. And when it's easy to give and it happens naturally, you often feel a sense of joy with that giving. Giving happens naturally, you feel inclined that way, and joy arises as a consequence. When the mind is joyful, it means you have mindfulness. There's few hindrances in the mind. And that kind of giving, when the joy is powerful, mindfulness is strong, there's few hindrances there, is very, very powerful. It leaves a very powerful impact on the mind. And because it leaves a powerful impact on the mind, this is one of the main causes that the karma becomes very strong, right, and very powerful. The impact is very strong. When the impact is very strong, when you then, next time you come to Dharma Grove and you sit down to meditate, because the impact was so powerful, that act of generosity, it will come back to you when you sit down. And you will feel happiness. You feel, wow, that was a wonderful thing. You don't even think that was a wonderful thing I did. You don't even think about it. You just think, wow, that was a beautiful thing. I gave that. It felt so good. Wow, what a beautiful thing that was. And this is then becomes a power of generosity, whereby it comes back to your mind easily again because of the impact it made in the first place. So this shows you what and how generosity should work. It should be done in a way whereby you feel happy, you feel joyous, you feel glad in the act of doing generosity. Both by thinking about it, you think about it, wow, I want to give something, and you think happy about that. Then you're happy while you give, and you're happy afterwards, right? It's just one big happy event. And then that is the best way of doing it. Of course, I'm not saying that we should not give to Buddhism. Of course, it's wonderful to support Buddhism. But it's how you give is more important. So how can you give to Buddhism to give rise to this idea, to give rise to joy? And one of the ways is to remember that when you give, don't give to individuals. Give to Buddhism as a cause, right? And when you give to Buddhism as a cause, you're giving to this massive, broad movement that exists around the world with all these various teachers in various places. If you give a gift, for example, if you give a donation while you're here, that money will go to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, which then will spread the Dhamma around the world through its YouTube channels and all these kind of things. And literally hundreds of thousands of people will be listening to those talks, right? So whenever you give to Buddhism, think about it in that way. You're giving to something which actually spreads out into the world. It's like a rock in water, the rings spreading out from one person to the next one. And you have a part in that, right? What is going on there? What is going on there is that people take on board these beautiful teachings of the Buddha, and it creates happiness in their life. It reduces the suffering, and it moves them forward in a positive way on the Buddha's path. Right? So you give, and you're creating happiness in the world. When you give, you're reducing suffering in the world for many, many, many people, because the Buddhist teachings are so vast and so wide, and you're helping with that. Right? Isn't that a beautiful thing? Every time you give, that's what you're doing. And when you think like that, when you think in the right way, when you turn your mind in the right direction, then you can get more happiness out of your act of generosity. So this is the how of generosity. So don't forget that. Remember the how, and remember that this is a foundational aspect of right view on the Buddhist path. So that is about So the first thing then is about understanding that there are beings in this world who have seen something more, generosity. And the third thing that the Buddha says in this sutta, again, is this kind of cryptic little statement that when you first read it, you just pass it over because you wonder, what is this all about? And the Buddha says, there is mother and father. And you, I remember reading this, and I thought, okay, and I read on, right? Again, just like one of those things, there is mother and father. It didn't mean anything to me. But then one day, I started to realize that, well, it is here as a foundation stone of the Buddhist path, part of right view, it must have some kind of meaning. It's not just there just because, you know, somebody decided to throw it in for good measure. That's not how the Buddha kind of does his teachings. It's there for a reason. So what does it mean that there is a mother and father? Well, what it means is that you have to understand the context of this idea of right view. The context of right view is all about karma and rebirth. So I'm talking about this in a second, but so karma and rebirth is like the context in which all these things of right view are framed. So what it means is that mother and father is a very powerful field of merit in the world, or of demerit if you happen it in the wrong way. That's basically what it means, right? In fact, it is so powerful that it is specifically mentioned as part of right view, right? That's how powerful it is. So what that means is that basically, unless you have that right view, and unless you act on that, you're holding back your own spiritual development. You're holding back your ability to progress in meditation, to progress on the Buddhist path. You have to take into account how you deal with your parents. If they're passed away, still, you can still deal with them in a certain way. This is an important part of the Buddhist path. If you ever hear somebody who says, I don't care about my parents or whatever, you can be absolutely sure that they are not they're not practicing the spiritual path properly. It's an essential part of this idea of right view. That's how important it is. And we know that. I mean, the Buddha's teachings talks a lot about the kind of karma that you can make with your parents. In particular, it talks about the bad karma, right? The Buddhist teaching says that if you kill your parents, it's one of the worst kinds of karma you can do, and it leads to very bad rebirth straight away. So this shows you the field of merit, right? Very powerful field of merit. If you get it wrongly, you will make terribly bad karma. If you get it rightly, you can make incredibly good karma. That's the reverse side of the coin. So because it is there, because it can actually give rise to all this positive merit, is a very important aspect of how we deal, how we practice the Buddhist path. So remember that. Good thing about many Asian cultures is this idea that you have a very kind of strong sense of obligation to your parents and this kind of thing. And I think that is a very good thing as it is. But also remember that when you have a strong sense of obligation, sometimes it can feel like a burden, right? You know, you are obliged to look after your parents. And if you are obliged, there's no joy in it. You just have to do it because this is what I'm supposed to do. I must do this because my culture says I'm supposed to do this. But if you make it into something negative because it is an obligation, then it loses its power to help you on the path. So you have to learn to perceive your parents, learn to look at them in a different way, in such a way that you can turn it into even something joyful, something beautiful, when you are, you know, doing your duties towards your parents, doing your duties towards your family members. And then it becomes a very, very powerful source of good karma when you do that. So how do we do that? How can we, you know, change our attitude to our parents in such a way that we can actually do support them in a joyful way, in a happy way? And the Buddha makes some very powerful statements about how to regard our parents in the suttas. And one of the things that he says is that parents are like Brahma. You know, Brahma in Buddhism is like the highest god. Brahma is someone who is reborn in one of the jhana realms, right? The realms also which have to do with the Brahma Viharas. You know, the Brahma Viharas, Metta, Karuna, and these kind of things. So Brahma is somebody who has this incredible Metta and loving kindness and compassion for the world. That's what the Brahma is like. That's what parents are. That's what the Buddha said. Parents are like Brahma. How can parents be like Brahma? Well, the reason, of course, is that they actually, if you start to reflect on it, they have done an enormous amount for us when we were younger. We wouldn't be alive, we wouldn't be here. unless it was for our parents. They have taught us almost everything we know in life, at least for the first few years. All the basic things that we need to know how to survive and to live were taught by our parents. And always they would have endless, like a mother has endless patience for her child, right? It's a beautiful thing that a mother, regardless of what her child does, she will always love that child, almost regardless. And this is the Brahma mind, right? The mind which is able to love regardless of what happens with that child. So a parent is like that. And when you think like that, when you think of actually all that you have received, the parent would not do that with anybody else in the world except for their own children. That's the only person they look after in this way. And what a beautiful thing that is, that parents actually do this towards us. So you need to change your perception, pull it around in a different way. It is so easy when we live in a family, it's so easy to see the faults and see the problems because we're so close together. You have to learn to shift your attention from those faults. And remember, there's a big picture here, which is much more beautiful and much more powerful than all the petty little things that causes problems in daily life. And when you do that, something beautiful happens. You start to see that there actually is something. The big picture is beautiful. The big picture is powerful. And then you can forgive all the pettiness, all the smallness, all the little problems in daily life. You can forgive that with so much more ease than you otherwise would be able to. So this is a powerful reflection. You can expand this reflection in many different ways. And to accompany that reflection of your parents as the Brahma God, right, the God of loving kindness, also at the same time, it's important to remember to accept your parents as ordinary human beings. They are ordinary human beings. They have their foibles, they have their problems. Of course they're going to make mistakes. Of course they're going to have bad habits. Of course they're going to do stupid things. That's par for the course. They're just human. We all do this. So that's okay. You can forgive that. What is amazing is that they had the ability, the willingness to look after us in such a way for such a long time. That is the amazing thing. So do that and then see. Sometimes you can maybe get a bit of joy and happiness into looking after your parents. When you have to help them out, you have to do something for them. And you find for the first time in your life, you feel, wow, what a wonderful thing it is to do. And the Buddha says, this is how we repay our parents. In fact, the Buddha said, we can never really repay our parents fully, but this is a kind of part and parcel of that, heading in the right direction. If your parents have already passed away, you can still do things for them. You can kind of, if you do a bit of metta meditation, I recommend you to bring your parents into your metta meditation every time. So when you sit down and you do some metta meditation, say, Mother and Father, wherever you are, may you be happy, may you be well. I wish you well in your new destination, wherever you are. If you want to, you can do some acts of kindness and generosity on behalf of your parents. And just tell your parents in your mind, I'm doing this for you, right? If they passed away. You can do forgiveness, you can say, if there's something that bothers you from the past, you can say to your parents even now, you know, whatever problems there were in the past, I forgive you 100%. Please also forgive me for anything that I did that was wrong in the past. And these are little ways we can even do things even after our parents have passed away to kind of help this process of the right view of the Buddhist path. So that is, it's amazing. I always find it so interesting that this thing is actually part of right view, right? There is mother, there is father. It shows us that there's something very important going on in a very basic Buddhist teaching there. So then, these are all, again, aspects of right view. And the last thing that I want to talk about, wow, it's been going on for a long time already. So the last thing I want to talk about is this idea of karma and rebirth, because this is also perhaps the one you really hear about all the time as foundational part of right view on the Buddhist path, right? Karma and rebirth, very foundational. And sometimes people think that karma and rebirth is like either you believe it or you don't, right? And so either you have right view or you have got wrong view. It's either one or the other. But actually, it's not really quite as simple as that. There are many people who think that, oh, I'm not sure if I can believe in rebirth. You know, rebirth is kind of this strange kind of religious idea that people had 2,500 years ago. Why? How can we believe in that in the modern world? So some people find it hard to believe in rebirth. And that's okay. You know, you can't force yourself to believe in rebirth. That's fine. So at the very end, for those people, the best thing they can do sometimes is just to keep an open mind, and that's okay. But what this shows you is that this idea of right view is a very, it's not like a yes you have it or you don't. There's this great variations of right view here. And one of the things that, and one of these variations is this idea that even if you do have confidence in the idea of rebirth, the confidence is often like an intellectual confidence. It's a feeling, yeah, rebirth makes sense to me, you know, I can sort of see why that could be the case. And you hear people talking about it, people who you have confidence in, etc. But that is still just intellectual. The really powerful kind of right view when it comes to rebirth is when this becomes part of your emotions. And you feel that there is something like rebirth. And when you start to feel it, that kind of right view is what is very, very powerful. So when you read about right view, when you think about right view, try to feel, what does it feel like? If you really were reborn, if you had a life in the past, what does that actually mean emotionally? What does it feel like to have been reborn in the past? And to give you an example of this, how this can actually change your whole outlook on life. There was a man here in Perth who came actually here to Jhana Grove a while ago. And he was one of these people who had done past life regression. And we have a past life regression as part of the Buddhist site WA. He does past life regressions. And this was one of his star students, right? And he had gone into the past life regression, had gone through this regression thing here. And then he started talking about his, you know, all of these things that happened in the past life. And he mentioned lots of details about what kind of house he lived in, what kind of clothes he was wearing, about what kind of brothers and sisters he had, where he was from. And all of these stories that actually came out. The story was that he had emigrated from Ireland, lots of Irish people in Australia. He had emigrated from Ireland about 150 years ago. He had started a farm in Australia. He'd been a soldier, first of all, and started a farm. And this was like his whole life story that he was able to tell, right? And then after telling this life story, he started to check the facts. Did such a person actually exist? He had the name as well, right? He could even remember the names. Did such a person exist? And of course, the amazing thing was that as he started to look into the past, he did find that 95% of the facts that he had talked about during that regression kind of ticked off, right? One after the other. And he said for him it was a traumatic experience, because for him, he was brought up as a Catholic. It was very hard to relate to the idea of rebirth. So he felt it was actually quite traumatic to be forced into this realization that there is rebirth. He couldn't deny it anymore. He had this memory, and the memory fitted so well with the facts of a person who actually had existed historically that he was incapable anymore of denying rebirth. And for him, it took him about a year before he was able to come to terms with the fact that, yes, I cannot, for me, it's impossible now to deny the idea of rebirth. The facts are so powerful. And so that happened. So this is the first part of the story, and that is not the most interesting part of the story. The most interesting part of the story is what happened to him psychologically as he went through this process. This person happens to be a businessman, and he does some business in Perth. He sells some things to the mining companies in the everything's about mining, mining in Perth. So he sells his part of that mining industry. And he's doing some fairly large contracts with some of these mining companies. He's a very down-to-earth kind of person. He's not kind of this person who is a bit flighty, you know, all kind of fantasy, all kind of things. Very down-to-earth kind of person. And he said that the most powerful thing, he started to change his life. He started to realize the power of virtue, wanting to be more kind and to actually be generous and to do the right thing in the world. He said he had shifted. Already he was a very virtuous person, because he was already a Buddhist. But this had kind of added that extra little thing, which made him even more kind and virtuous than before. Why? Because he had seen this connection, right? He had seen how his habits from the past life were kind of just tended to carry on into the new life. He was still doing pretty much the same thing as before. And he wasn't able to change those habits. He said, "Jeepers, I'm just like a robot. I'm a robot moving from one life into the next one. I'm on these tracks, in this rut, and I'm not able to move out of it. This is scary." So he was able to add a little bit of extra to move himself out of those ruts, out of the tracks, to be more kind and more virtuous than he had been in the past. And this is, I think, one of those scary moments when you see the past life. You see how you are as a person. You keep on moving. The person you were in the past life is carrying on in the present life, right? And that is a person who is likely to carry on into the future as well. You bring your defilements with you. You bring your stupidity with you. You make the same mistakes again and again. And you see, wow, this actually is very scary and very frightening. And when you see that directly like he did, it's very powerful. And the second thing that he realized, this was also to me very fascinating and interesting, was he said that even though he was doing all these business deals, even though he was set up perhaps to make hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of dollars through his business, it didn't mean anything to him anymore. He lost interest in that. It is not so important. Okay, he's still carrying on, but the whole thing is like, okay, if it works out, fine. If it doesn't work out, I couldn't care less, really. That's what he said. And again, it's the same thing. Again, what he was seeing there was exactly the same thing. He was looking into his past life, and he was seeing that in his past life, too, he had been doing business. And then he had, at that time, he was a farmer. And at the end of his life, he was very proud, right? I started an island with two empty hands. I was completely poor. I had absolutely nothing. And I built up a life for myself. And he was very proud of that and very happy about that. But then he was seeing that in this life, he was doing exactly the same thing, right? He was starting off with not much. And then he was building up his business. And now he was starting to feel proud of his business. And he was seeing again that he was just following the same old patterns, doing the same thing again and again. And in every life, every time you're reborn, it seems so important, right? This is what life is really about. Wow, it's so important. I've got to get out there. I've got to get my degree from university. I've got to get a wife and or a husband and get a nice house and get a family together. I've got to get my business going. It all seems so important until you realize that you're actually in a rut. You're just a habit. You're just doing the same thing again and again and again, life after life, because you are trapped in this. It's a trap, right? And that's what you see. When you see the past life, you see that you're actually trapped. You can't get out of it. You know, it looks like you have free choice. You're doing this because you want to do it. No, you're doing it because you did it in the past. That's why you're doing it. So this is what I mean by right view. It's not just about, yeah, I believe in rebirth. Yeah, I have confidence in this. It makes sense to me. It's about understanding that this actually is a very powerful emotional thing when you understand it in the right way, which steers you in a new direction because you don't want to be trapped anymore. You don't want to be a robot who's just trapped in the same old things. You want to change your attitude and move in a different way. And in this way, the idea of karma and rebirth becomes so powerful, right? You can see how powerful it is. It has the power to change the whole trajectory, the whole direction of your life, and move you in a new direction. And this is why it is so important. This is why it is the basis of right view, and how right view itself is something which can be moved and changed if you use it in the right way. Those are the basic things that the Buddha talks about there as right view. You can talk about many other things as well, about virtue, kindness, and all these kind of things. They all work. But these are some of the things that are perhaps a little bit different from what you have sometimes heard about. I'm sure you heard about many of these things before, but anyway, that's just my take on some of these things. So think about that, reflect on these things, and then when you come back here next year, or you go to a different meditation center somewhere else, or whatever you do, then look and see if it has an impact on your meditation practice. If it has had an impact on your meditation, you know you're on the right path. If your meditation is still the same, well, then you need to think, well, what can I do? What can I change to improve the foundation stone, the sila, the virtue, the character building here? And then when you reflect like this, then there is a good chance you will make good progress on this Buddhist path. Okay, so there you are. Eddie, yeah? Okay, so just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.